Dr. Robert C. Newman, Professor of New Testament at Biblical Theological Seminary.
Our subject for this evening is Israel, Evidence of God from History. The Prussian king, Frederick the Great, rather well known as a free thinker during the Enlightenment period, once asked his chaplain, "Give me a one-word proof for the existence of God." And his chaplain, who was well aware of the material in the Bible and had studied history rather well, said, "The Jews. The Jews are evidence for the existence of God." We'd like to try and look at that this evening to see how it is that the nation Israel, as the people of Israel, as well as the land of Israel, give us evidence that there is a God who is operating in history, even though history seems to us to be hard to interpret, although it's very complicated. Yet, there is a God who is in control of history, and he demonstrates that to us through the correlation between predictions in his word and the events that have happened to the nation Israel. We'd like to survey, first of all, various prophecies, not a complete set by any means, but a small group of prophecies relating to the people Israel that appear in Scripture. First of all, we'd like to start with the books of Moses. These have been dated various different times, and it will not be terribly crucial what date we give to them for this particular concern, but I'll take the early date for the Exodus and say the books of Moses come to us from around 1400 B.C. In the 26th chapter of the book of Leviticus, we have a series of prophecies regarding the land of Israel that are conditional prophecies. "If you keep my commandments," says God through Moses, "then things will work out very well for you. Your threshing will last until grape gathering. You'll have such a big harvest that you'll be busy harvesting the grains until the time comes to harvest the grapes. You'll eat your food to the full and live securely in your land. I'll also grant peace in the land so that you may lie down with no one making you tremble. I will also eliminate harmful beasts from the land. No sword will pass through your land. You will chase your enemies. They will fall before you by the sword. Five of you will chase 100, and 100 of you will chase 10,000. Enemies will fall before you by the sword. So will I turn toward you and make you fruitful and multiply you, and I'll confirm my covenant with you. And you will eat the old supply and clear out the old because of the new." It won't be a matter of having to go on tight rations the last 2 months before the harvest because you're running out. Rather, you'll get to the harvest period, and you'll still have a lot left over from the previous harvest, and you'll have to throw it out in order to make room for the new. "Moreover, I'll make my dwelling among you. My soul will not reject you. But if you do not obey me and do not carry out all my commands," then we have a series of curses. "If instead you reject my statutes so that your whole soul abhors my ordinances so as not to carry out all my commandments and so break my covenant, I in turn will do this to you. I will appoint over you a sudden terror, consumption and fever that shall waste away the eyes and cause the soul to find a way. Also you shall sow your seed uselessly, for your enemies shall eat it up. Set my face against you so that you will be struck down before your enemies. Those who hate you shall rule over you, and you shall flee when no one is pursuing you. If also after these things you do not obey me, then I will punish you seven times more for your sins." And goes into a second set of curses which would come upon the Israelites. And this is repeated several times. That if Israel does not obey God, then God will send worse plagues. If he does not obey them, he will send still worse plagues. And we see this section then, this is all Leviticus 26, although the plagues get worse and worse and worse to the extent that the Israelites do not turn back to God, yet they will not be destroyed. "If they confess their iniquity," verse 40, "and the iniquity of their forefathers in their unfaithfulness which they have committed against me, and also in their acting with hostility against me, then I will remember my covenant with Jacob. I will remember also my covenant with Isaac, my covenant with Abraham. I will remember the land, for the land shall be abandoned by them, shall make up for its Sabbaths," etc. "Yet in spite of this, when they are in the land of their enemies, I will not reject them," verse 44, "nor will I so abhor them as to destroy them, breaking my covenant with them, for I am the Lord their God. But I will remember for them the covenant with their ancestors, whom I brought out of the land of Egypt in the sight of the nations, that I might be their God. I am the Lord." briefly summarize then, the predictions of Leviticus 26 are good things will happen to Israel when they are doing what the Lord wants, when they are seeking the Lord. Disastrous things will happen when they turn away. And these disasters will get worse and worse as long as they remain away from Him. But God will not destroy. As a nation, God will not destroy Israel. Rather, He will continue keeping His side of the covenant with them. And they will one day, we gather from this, they will confess their iniquity. And He will bring them back. He will remember the covenant and will bring them back. Deuteronomy chapter 28, verses 62 through 68. What happens after all these disasters comes upon Israel? After all these disasters, verse 62 says, "Then you shall be few in number, even though you were as the stars in heaven for multitude, before the disasters began to happen, because you did not obey the Lord your God. That shall come about that as the Lord delighted over you to prosper you and multiply you, so the Lord will delight over you to make you perish, destroy you. You shall be torn from the land where you're entering to possess it. More of the Lord will scatter you among all peoples from one end of the earth to the other end of the earth. There you shall serve other gods. And among those nations you shall find no rest, and there shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. But there the Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, and despair of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you. You shall be in dread night and day. You shall have no assurance of your life. In the morning you will say, 'Would that it were evening!' And at evening you shall say, 'Would that it were morning!' Because the dread of your heart, which you dread, for the sight of your eyes, which you shall see. The Lord will bring you back to Egypt in ships by the way about which I spoke to you. You shall never see it again. And there you shall offer yourselves for sale to your enemies as male and female slaves, but there will be no buyer." So here, made even more clear, the scattering which would occur to Israel, the fact that they would have no rest among the nations, that it would be even difficult to sell them as slaves. All of this from the period Moses in Leviticus chapter 26, Deuteronomy chapter 28. Now let's move onward, 700 years. In the 11th chapter of the book of Isaiah, we find a scattering discussed. And then in Isaiah chapter 11, verse 11, we find these statements. "Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will recover the second time with His hand the remnant of His people who will remain." Here is God a second time recovering the remainder of His people. Tells where He recovers them from Assyria, Egypt, Pathros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamat, and from the islands of the sea. He will lift up a standard for the nations and will assemble the banished ones of Israel. He will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. "Then the jealousy of Ephraim, the northern kingdom of Israel, will depart. Those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah, and Judah will not harass Ephraim. There will be a unity among the two parts of Israel that had split into warring nations around 931 B.C. and had been that way for about 200 years down to the time of Isaiah. And they, that presumably is the united Israelites, will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Together they will plunder the sons of the east. They will possess Edom and Moab, and the sons of Ammon shall be subject to them. The Lord will utterly destroy the tongue of the sea of Egypt. He will wave His hand over the river. With a scorching wind, He will strike it into seven streams." Such. So here we see, rather clearly stated here, that there will come a time when the Lord will gather back the Israelites. It says He'll do it a second time, which is rather interesting because about 100 years after this time, Israel is scattered among the nations. The first time they are scattered, and then they're brought back about 70 years after that time. But here it says God will recover them a second time. He seems to be looking beyond that first scattering, and we'll have more to say about that later. Thirdly, about the same time that we've looked at Leviticus and Deuteronomy and suggested a date around 1400 B.C., and now we've looked at Isaiah around 700 B.C., and we want to look also at Hosea, approximately the same date. The book of Hosea contains a number of rather interesting topics, but one of them is an acted parable showing God's relationship to Israel. This is a rather striking acted parable because it involved a good bit of the prophet Hosea's life. Hosea was commanded to go out and marry a woman who was a prostitute. This was apparently intended to be representative of God's having taken Israel out of slavery in Egypt. And then they had children. Doesn't tell us for sure whether they're Hosea's children or not. But anyway, they have children, and they are named certain things to show the unfaithfulness of the nation Israel to God. Finally, the last child is named, "Not My People." Then apparently, Hosea's wife Gomer leaves him, goes off somewhere, and finally Hosea finds his wife, and she's apparently in slavery. And that's where this chapter picks up, third chapter of Hosea, shortest chapter of the book. "Then the Lord said to me, 'Go again, love a woman who is loved by her husband, yet an adulteress, even as the Lord loves the sons of Israel, though they turn to other gods and love raisin cakes,'" nothing wrong with raisin cakes, but has something to do with idolatrous worship. "So I bought her for myself for 15 shekels of silver, and we'd say a bushel and a half of barley." That sort. So Hosea buys back his unfaithful wife from slavery. "Then I said to her, 'You shall stay with me for many days. You shall not play the harlot,'" I'm going to keep her so that she does not go out, "'nor shall you have a man.' I will have no relationship with you. So I will also be toward you." What's the lesson of this? The sons of Israel will remain for many days without a king or prince, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols or teraphim. Afterwards, the sons of God will return and seek the Lord their God and David their king. They will come trembling to the Lord and to his goodness in the last days. It's a rather explicit statement here. The sons of Israel will remain for many days without sacrifice. God had commanded that they should sacrifice to him, a rather elaborate system of sacrifice by which alone God promised them that he would bring atonement for sins. And yet the prediction is they'll be for many days without such sacrifice. They'll be without king, without prince. Let's say without king, without government official. Be more accurate. Prince sounds a little too much like a king's son in English. They would be without pillars. This would appear from archaeology to be some sort of stone or wooden devices that represented the worship of Baal and of his consort Ashtoreth, a Canaanite god and goddess of fertility. You'll be without an ephod. An ephod was a technical name for a part of the high priest's garment. The impression you get is they will be without a high priesthood. Be without king and government official. Be without ephod and sacred pillar. Be without teraphim. No idolatry. Very strange prediction. We want to look at one last prediction before we begin to look at fulfillments. That is one that comes from the New Testament. Statement of Jesus made during his ministry. Jesus, as he presents himself to the people of his time, found that the officials, the religious elite of Israel, were not willing to accept him. He warned them that they search the scriptures and doesn't discourage that at all. In fact, one could even translate that, "Search the scriptures, because you think that in them you have eternal life." But he says, "It is they, these scriptures, that bear witness of me. But you are unwilling to come to me that you may have life. I have come in my Father's name," he says, verse 43, "and you do not receive me. If another shall come in his own name, you will receive him. How can you believe when you receive glory from one another and you do not seek the glory that is from the one and only God?" Jesus calls the religious leaders of his time to task because they are in danger of rejecting him, and they do carry that on through. And they say, he says, "I've come in my Father's name, in my Father's authority, doing works and miracles, things of that variety. You're not receiving me. Another person is going to come in his own name. Him you will receive." So here's just a little scattering of some of the predictions about Israel. There are many, many more predictions of this sort, but we want to just look at a few of these and look now at the history of Israel, starting back before the time of Isaiah, and work our way down to the present time, hitting here and there features of the history of the nation Israel. Israel, in 931, split into two nations after a brilliant period as far as men would be concerned, under David, spreading the kingdom, and then under Solomon, enjoying the wealth that came in with, at that time, the strongest kingdom in the Middle East. In 931, the northern tribes revolted against Solomon's successor because the taxes were too high, because the work levies were too high. And so you split into two kingdoms, the small kingdom to the south here, Judah, and the large kingdom to the north, known as Israel or Ephraim. Within 200 years, the time of this split, the Assyrians began to spread their kingdom. Had been a rather important kingdom here in the Mesopotamian Valley, centered at Nineveh. This kingdom began to spread and to take control of all the Middle East. A very bloodthirsty conquest that the Assyrians carried on. In a situation where the city had resisted their attack, they would often, when they had taken the city, bring out some of the people and skin them alive. They would sharpen poles, drive them into the ground, and impale people on them, watch them wriggle until they died. Very bloodthirsty kingdom. That kingdom spread all the way out to the Mediterranean and then down the coast until it came in contact with the two kingdoms, Israel and Judah. And Israel finally, the northern kingdom, finally caved in under the attacks of the Assyrians in the year 722 B.C. The Assyrians came, set up a siege against Samaria, built well fortified on a hilltop, but the northern kingdom with its capital could not hold out indefinitely, and finally in 722 the Assyrians came in and essentially destroyed the whole northern kingdom. They took the people still living and they deported them up on the headwaters of the Tigris River. And so a whole half of the Israelite nation was carried out of their homeland almost 1,000 miles away. And though people have talked about the lost 10 tribes of Israel, I don't know there's any evidence they're lost, but they have not in mass ever returned to their own time, to their own place. So here we have a half of the nation, because turning away from God, setting up their own religion, which they proceeded to do after the split in 931 in order to keep the people of the northern kingdom from going down to Jerusalem to worship, God began to bring disasters against them and finally destroyed that whole kingdom. The southern kingdom, according to the biblical accounts, was miraculously preserved. The southern kingdom of Judah was reduced to one city, the capital, Jerusalem. And according to the biblical account, God miraculously intervened to kill off a substantial fraction of the Assyrian army, after which the Assyrians decided to go home. The Assyrians don't mention any miraculous intervention, but the best that the king of Assyria is able to say is that he shut up the southern kingdom, Judah, like a bird in its cage. He says he destroyed the city, destroyed that city, destroyed that city, and then he comes to Jerusalem. I shut up King Hezekiah like a bird in a cage. And that's the best he can put on his historical records. It appears then that something rather drastic happened that called off the siege against Jerusalem. Yet Jerusalem did not, and its inhabitants did not seem to take any lesson from this. They continued on, turning away from God, carrying idolatry of various sorts, even into the very temple precincts itself. There's some very striking passages in the book of Ezekiel, how Ezekiel saw sun worship in the very courts of the temples, how he saw certain other types of idolatrous worship in the buildings of the temple. And God then allowed another nation to rise up, a nation which took part in the destruction of the Assyrian kingdom, and that was the Neo-Babylonian Empire, centered at Babylon, and under the command of, first of all, Nabopolassar, and then his son Nebuchadnezzar, who finished off the work. Nebuchadnezzar finally came down into Palestine and down to Jerusalem, deported a few people around 606 B.C., deported some more at 597 B.C., put in a new king. That king finally rebelled, and in 587 he came, and a siege was set against Jerusalem, and the city was burned, destroyed, torn down, and the inhabitants of Jerusalem were carried off to the area of Babylon. Both of these nations had a deportation policy. The best way to keep their empire together, they figured, was to mix up the members of the of the different races that they had conquered so that they would not be able to understand each other, and therefore it would be harder to hatch plots. So they moved them out of their native territories, resettled them in various other locations. Now, with this destruction, we have a period of about 50 years from 587 BC until 537, when another empire comes into existence in the Middle East, the Persian Empire. And a rather interesting feature, the Persian Empire, the emperor over the Persians, Cyrus, as he was called, changed the whole policy of empires in the Middle East. The Assyrians had been deporting people, the Babylonians had been deporting people. Cyrus decided that he could rule the place better by allowing people to go back to their homelands. And so he sent a number of groups back, or allowed groups to go back, and he allowed the Israelites to come back. And so they come back from this captivity. Not all the Israelites, but the Israelites of the area around Babylon come back. We might ask ourselves, was Isaiah 11:11 and following fulfilled at this period of time? Is this a point when these things were said to have happened? Well, will recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain does not sound like it's talking about this period. You might say, well, maybe it is. Maybe the first time is gathering them out of Egypt, and this is the second time. Notice what else is said, though. He will gather them from Assyria, Egypt, Patros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and the islands of the sea. Here's the area to which the exile of the northern and southern kingdoms took place. A big spot down here on the lower Tigris and Euphrates for the place the southern kingdom was taken, those of Judah, and those of Ephraim or Israel were taken up into this area here. The return, the time of Cyrus and following for a couple generations, comes out of part of this area where the southern kingdom was sent. But the area mentioned in Isaiah 11, Edith, Egypt, Patros, Cush, Hamath, Elam, Shinar, Assyria, and the coastlands of the sea, very little of that is actually touched in that particular prediction. It does not appear, then, that the prediction relates to this particular event. So, the Israelites, then, are under the Persian Empire for several hundred years, from 537 to 332, and they don't have a very good time of it, but they're not persecuted. They're allowed to operate in their own land. They're allowed to have a high priest. One might wonder also at this point whether or not Hosea has been fulfilled at this point. The sons of Israel will be for many days without king, without prince, without sacred pillar, without sacrifice, without ephod, without teraphim. Say, well, the Israelites were in Babylon. The southern kingdom was in Babylon for 70 years or 50 years, depending on what date you use to count from. Did they have a king? Well, they didn't have a ruling king, but in fact, in the Babylonian records, we find that the guy in exile was called king. So that Jehoiakim in exile was called king. So they had a king in some sense, and his line was remembered through this period, so that when the Persians set up an empire, they sent back one of the grandson of Jehoiakim, named Zerubbabel, and brought him back as a governor of some sort. He was never king, but he was a government official. So you could say, in some sense, they had a king and officials through this period, even though they were in exile. They did not, of course, have any sacrifice. We don't know whether they had household idols or not. That would take a rather careful census, which would be difficult to check out at this time. So there's some problem there. But it does not look like this particular event was fulfilled at that time, at least in regard to its governmental matters. To what extent idolatry had ended during this period is hard to say. It appears that that after the Babylonian captivity, the southern kingdom, as they come back, are not involved in idolatry. But there were certainly people during this captivity who fled to Egypt. We learn in the book of Jeremiah, they were indeed involved in idolatrous practices. In the year 332 BC, however, a great conqueror, Alexander the Great, comes into the Middle East and sweeps across with less than 100,000 soldiers, sweeps across the decaying Persian Empire, and in the course of less than 10 years, conquers the whole Persian Empire, adding it to his own domains of Macedonia and Greece. Alexander was very good to the Jews during the period of time that he lived. The story that we have in Josephus is that he was shown the scrolls of the book of Daniel, which predicted him, and therefore he believed that he was fated by God, as he would say, to rule the world, and he treated the Jews well. Most liberals do not believe such events ever occurred, but basically they say that on the basis of not believing in the miraculous. They've tried to date the book of Daniel much later than that time. But Alexander's conquest was certainly quite important, covered an enormous area, as you can see here in the green, brought other areas under economic control, though not actually under his power. And the result of this was to spread Greek ideas into the Middle East. It tended to scatter the Jews even more, because although Alexander got along rather well with them, and a number of his successors did, the successors would often use Jews as citizens in new cities, which they founded. If you look over a map like this, you'll find that there are many Alexandrias scattered all over the place. Alexander was not the most self-effacing person in the world. He founded many cities and could never think of better names than Alexandria. His successors were similar sort, so Antiochus founded many Antiochs, Seleucus founded many Seleucias, Ptolemy founded many Ptolemaises, and various other things of that sort happened. But the result is that the Jews began to be scattered more and more from the area in which they had originally been deported to, here in the Tigris-Euphrates Valley, and the area to which they had returned in Palestine, so that by the New Testament times you find Jews scattered almost all over the Roman Empire. Virtually every city has a substantial number of them. Meanwhile, back in Palestine, we have a number of different rulers, successors of Alexander, as he dies suddenly at the age of 33, trying to take control of Palestine. And finally, around the year 168 B.C., a fellow by the name of Antiochus IV, or Antiochus Epiphanes, as he called himself, he considered himself to be a manifestation of the god Zeus, made an attempt to destroy the Jews and their religion. He made a ruling that all scrolls of Scripture were to be destroyed, that no one was to circumcise their children, that study of the Torah, of course, was forbidden along with even having the Torah, that sacrifices were to be made to Zeus, who was manifest in Antiochus. And a rather striking thing happened. A very small nation, the Jews at this point in Palestine, tried a guerrilla warfare against him. Huge empire, which Antiochus had under his control. All of Asia Minor, all of Mesopotamian Valley, all of Syria and Palestine, and yet he lost the war. Of course, there are reasons you can find, but we're talking about God working in history. We're not talking about particularly miraculous interventions, but God working in history that protected the Israelites from being destroyed, although we have here a rather definite attempt to do it, which has been noted by a number of people as the earliest attempt at genocide that is recorded. And yet it did not succeed, even though it was carried on by the head of a rather wealthy empire. The Jews survived that under the Maccabees and began a period of independence, which lasts from about 160 to 63 B.C., about 100 years, when finally the Roman Empire comes onto the scene as far as the East is concerned, and they come in to arbitrate a dispute between the successors, two claimants for the throne, for the high priesthood in Jerusalem, and the Roman general Pompey is called upon to arbitrate. His arbitration is rather arbitrary, we might say. He decides that one of the guys is the winner and says, you may be ethnarch under the Roman Empire. He was king before, now he winds up being a subsection of the Roman Empire, and so a fourth empire has come into this area and taken control of Palestine. The Roman Empire itself was probably as big as the other empires, although it extended in the opposite direction. Whereas the others we have seen extended east, this one extends west, and so the Jews are further scattered as the Roman Empire begins to grow, and to the extent that they are all over the Mediterranean area, as we say, by New Testament times. The Jews get along fairly well with the Romans for the first half century or so, not too well, as you can suppose. They're not too happy to have their dispute arbitrated in this way, which turns out to involve them in substantial taxes for a long time and getting worse. And then gradually they find that their country is being bled dry by the taxation. I suppose the Romans would not see it that way. That's the way the Jews saw it and seem to have had some warrant for that. Well, about this time, the beginning of the Christian era, you begin to have people coming along who say, I'm the promised Redeemer, which God said he was going to send. I'm the Messiah, and I'm going to lead you in battle against the Romans. Early in the first century, several people try this, but they never are able to gather much of a group. Gather 200, 500, 1,000, 3,000, and the Romans are always able to come down with a large force and disperse the operation, kill the men, and that's the end of that. But later in the century, things begin to get worse and worse. A especially incompetent run of Roman governors are in Palestine, doing rather what appears to have been intentionally provocative acts, trying to make their fortune in a couple years before they leave on taxation, things of that sort. And the result is finally in 66 AD, the Jews revolt against Rome, and for 4 years they hold out against the Roman power. But finally in the year 70 AD, the Romans are able to come in and storm the city of Jerusalem, burn the place down, tear it apart. A very striking thing happens when the Romans take Jerusalem. They kill almost 1 million people in the city situation, according to the historians, not accepted by all modern historians, but according to the historians at the time, they kill almost 1 million people between the famine and plague and such associated with the siege and then the final assault. The city was crowded with pilgrims who had come in to one of the pilgrim feasts when the siege had begun, and then many more had flocked in there because it was the best fortified city in Palestine. Result is enormous crowds. Even killing all of these people, there were an enormous number of captives left over when the city had been taken, and the Romans got tired of killing people. They tried to sell them on the slave markets. They hauled a large number down into Egypt, and it got to the point where they couldn't bring any price in Egypt. It drove the price of slave market down so bad that you would hardly believe it. And yet, as we look back into the Leviticus passage, the Deuteronomy passage, we find this remark that you will be carried back to Egypt in ships. You'll be sold as male and female slaves. Nobody will buy you. It's so bad, not even able to sell the slaves. And yet, this 70 AD begins what now is a rather terrifying period for the Jews. Up until this period, with the exception of about 50 years in the 6th century, Israel has always had a homeland. They've always had a temple. They've always had someone to officiate over the temple. They've been able to sacrifice, and therefore, in accordance with the Mosaic prescriptions, they have been able to have forgiveness for sins. But now, the temple is gone. The high priesthood is gone. The records to keep track of who would be in the descent of the high priesthood are gone, and that, of course, then is lost. The information would be lost within a generation or so. And so you really begin to have a situation in which Israel has no homeland. The Romans celebrated their victory by minting coins, on the back of which it says, Judea Capta, a captive Judea, and shows a woman weeping under a palm tree, date palm, I guess that is, a picture of the disaster that had come upon Israel at that time. With the destruction of Israel, there's only a very small situation of the Jews left in Palestine. A few of the rabbis are able to escape at the end of the siege, and one of them, Yohanan ben Zakkai, is given permission by the Roman general Vespasian, later to become emperor, to have the coastal city Jamnia, called Yavna in Hebrew, and able to set up a rabbinical school. But at this point, we begin to have a development of something rather different in the worship of Israel. Before this time, on the basis of what the biblical material says, the Jews have understood that sacrifice is necessary for forgiveness of sins. But now they've got no temple. And they have understood another passage in Scripture, I don't think they properly understood it there, that you can't sacrifice without a temple. Of course, they'd done that before they'd had the temple. And the result is, with the destruction of the temple, they begin to try and develop a theology by which they don't need sacrifice for forgiveness of sins. And so now, having lost their homeland, they also are trying to justify forgiveness without sacrifice. But notice that's introducing a feature of the prediction of Hosea, chapter 3. They will be for many years without ephod, no high priest, without pillar, and the pillar can be both idolatrous or a pillar of the temple, without sacrifice, that's quite clearly involving the whole question of the Mosaic religion, and yet without household idols. They develop a religion that is without idolatry in the sense of worshiping images, but it's also not the religion that they have in the books that they accept as the scripture. Very, very strange situation. And yet it begins to date from this very period when they lose their kingdom also, when they no longer have a king. One might argue that they still have government officials at this point, although they are really not in much of a situation of that sort. That was about 70 AD when that occurs. And during the period then of 70 to 135, the rabbis are developing a new set of arrangements which will govern their activities without a temple. As we come into the 2nd century AD, one of the Roman emperors, Hadrian is his name, decides to build a city on the site of Jerusalem, a pagan city, and to erect pagan temples on the holy sites. The Jews remaining in Palestine, a rather small remnant scattered here and there now, decide to resist this, and one man comes forward to lead them. The fellow was Simeon ben Kosiba, and by a play on his name, the rabbi Akiba, one of the leading rabbis of the period, claimed that this fellow was the Messiah, that he was the fulfillment of the passage in Numbers where it says a star shall arise from Jacob. And so he played on his name, Kosiba, and modified it slightly to Kokva, which means star in Hebrew, and said, you are Simeon, son of a star. You are the Messiah. And so the Jews in Palestine rallied around Ben Kosiba, who came in his own name, and whose own name was taken to be a fulfillment of prophecy, and they followed him for several years to a great disaster. When the revolt had been put down thoroughly by the Romans, they then decided that not only were was the city of Jerusalem destroyed, but no Jew would be allowed to come within 10 miles of the city on pain of death. And so any Jewish settlement in the near vicinity of Jerusalem ends at this point. One can hardly discuss a matter of a government now for the Jews, or a matter of a king, and no opportunity to even get back to their holy places. So we see then a fulfillment of this remark in John chapter 5. I've come in my Father's name, says Jesus, and you do not receive me. If another shall come in his own name, you will receive him. And yet this happens again and again and again through Jewish history, when claimants for the Messiahship come forward. With the destruction of this revolt, Israel is now basically in dispersion, though there are a scattering of Jews around Tiberias, Sea of Galilee, that sort of area. Still out, I believe even Jamnia is not a major center anymore after this point. At the end of the century, the work of the rabbis in reformulating the theology has reached a very major point with the publication of the work called the Mishnah. This is the core material of the Talmud, the basic work which puts together the understanding which the rabbis had of the law and how to have forgiveness without sacrifice, how to justify that they would be acceptable even though they had been driven from their temple site, even though they had lost their sacrifice and had lost the high priesthood. Coming onward to 500 AD, we have the completion of the much larger work, which is a commentary on the Mishnah and is usually published with it, the whole name of the whole being the Talmud. And you now have in 35 volumes, in English translation anyway, the Babylonian Talmud, which is really the basis then of rabbinic theology, the basis of mainstream Judaism from that time to this time. A construction in which good works, in which prayers and things of this sort are felt to be the sort of thing which replaces sacrifice rather than sacrifice having actually to be held. All during this period, the Jews are up and down in regard to the way they are treated. They, of course, had been disastrously handled in the revolt in 70 AD. the revolt in 135, both disasters occurring in Palestine. In 117 AD, some of the Jews out in the outlying areas, out in Egypt and such, had revolted, and that had been put down very severely, so that the Jews were treated rather as second-class citizens in the Roman Empire. With the rise of Christianity and the acceptance of a rather modified form of Christianity as a religion of the Roman Empire late in the 5th century, around 490 by Theodosius, you begin to have mistreatment of the Jews by the Christians. There, of course, had been rather bad relations between the Jews and the Christians. In the Jamnia period, the rabbis had desired to get Christians out of the synagogue by putting among the prayers of the synagogue a curse against Christians. And various things had gone on since that time, and now the Christians coming to some political power are getting back at them. And we see some other rather strange things at this period, an attempt by a Roman emperor, Julian the Apostate, who had turned from Christianity back to paganism, an attempt to have the temple at Jerusalem rebuilt. He said he would provide the money and provide the Jews the opportunity to go back, rebuild the city of Jerusalem, rebuild the temple. Something strange happened. Nobody's sure whether it was miraculous intervention or whether it was merely some strange natural phenomena. But as they begin to dig around the place, they begin to see balls of fire, whether it was lightning or explosions or just what. It's interesting that this material is found both in pagan and Christian authors from within a year of the events. Very strange phenomena. And yet Julian's own intention was that he would show the New Testament was wrong because it had said Jerusalem will be trodden down by the Gentiles until the time of the Gentiles is fulfilled. And he said, I'll show them that's not so. We will rebuild the temple. Send back the Jews to rebuild the temple. The workmen got so scared by the events going on that the activity stopped and has never been completed since that time. Shortly after 500, around 622, we have the beginning of Islam. Illiterate Arab fellow claimed that he had received special revelations from God and that he was called upon to bring about a restoration of the true religion which had existed before Judaism and Christianity had mucked it up. And he began to gather followers. He had a different evangelistic procedure than some other religions. It's called the Occam's razor method. Maybe we should call it Abdul Sword method. You had three choices if you were a Christian. You had three choices if you were a Jew. You had two choices if you were a pagan. Choice one for all three was the sword. Choice two was to become a Muslim. And choice three, good for Christians and Jews only, was that you could become a second-class citizen. That third arrangement was not even made right at the beginning. And as a result, Islam spread very quickly. We see that within 10 years of the beginning, what's usually dated as the beginning of Islam, 622, Muhammad's flight from Mecca, we have Islam in control of the whole Arabian Peninsula. Big area, not many people in it, of course. By 656, less than 30 years after the death of Muhammad, all of the orange area has been filled in. Another century carries you out to all of the blue area. Notice that Muslims were able to take all of North Africa, all the inhabited parts, this is all Sahara Desert down under here. They had taken all of Spain and were actually headed into France. They were stopped all the way up there at Tours, you see, in the middle of France in 732 AD. It's kind of the high tide of Islam in the West, and continued to push against the Eastern Roman Empire for another 700 years until they took Constantinople, 1453. The Muslims certainly did not treat the Jews the best in the world, although after initial troubles, the Jews were allowed to settle in a number of areas and settle somewhat second-class citizens, but certainly not being persecuted. Many, many Jews settled in Spain at that time. Jews being scattered, persecuted off and on through this period, but no real attempts apparently to wipe them out so far. When we come up to the time, AD 1000, we come to the period of the Crusades. The Crusades started out as an attempt by nominal Christians in Europe to retake the Holy Land because the new variety of the Muslims, the Seljuk Turks, would not allow Christian pilgrims to go back and visit the various holy sites around Jerusalem and Bethlehem and such. But as the Crusades began to develop, as the men gathered together from various places in Europe and began to head down into the regions that the Turks had under their control, they began to come in contact also with the Jews. And they reminded themselves and even mishandled somewhat the biblical materials regarding the activity of the Jews in rejection of Christianity. And so in many, many cities, we find the Crusaders persecuting the Jews, breaking down their houses, taking them out, attempting to force conversions in a somewhat similar method to the method the Muslims had used earlier. And so a very, very difficult time for the Jews during this period. One example of the situation in this period is Rabbi Meir in the Holy Roman Empire. Emperor Rudolf of the Holy Roman Empire brought in Meir and decided he would extract money from the Jews, because this was a very famous and beloved rabbi, by putting Rabbi Meir in prison until the Jews would raise a ransom to get him out. Well, the Jews would very well have raised a huge ransom for him, but Meir refused to have them raise a ransom. He died in prison after several years imprisonment. And yet, as far as we can tell here, there was no persecution against him except that he was a Jew, except that it was a way to extort some money, which in fact did not work out. And we begin to see the fulfillment of these predictions of not being safe anywhere, of being fearful. During the Crusades, we find also in England the beginning of activities that we see again and again all over Europe, a command that all Jews must leave a given realm. 1290, Edward I proclaims that all Jews must leave England. I suppose they could have converted, that would be all right, but must leave England. And so they're just shoved out of the whole country. People who've lived there for hundreds of years, working in various forms of activity. Their activities, the sort of work they could do, was very heavily restricted. Driven out of the area, year 1492, which we usually remember for Columbus's activity, was also the year in which the kingdoms of Spain finally drove the Muslims out of Spain, finally pushed the Moors, as they were called in that area, off the tip of Spain. And it was also the year in which Ferdinand and Isabella signed the edict that all Jews must leave Spain, an area which for centuries the Jews had been rather wealthy, had been allowed a certain amount of freedom, though they were definitely second-class citizens under the Muslims. Now they are either forced to leave or to convert to Christianity. And a very large number are forced out of the area. And so we see this remark in Deuteronomy. Among the nations you shall find no rest. There shall be no resting place for the sole of your foot. The Lord will give you a trembling heart, failing of eyes, despair of soul. So your life shall hang in doubt before you. You shall be in dread day and night. There shall be no assurance of your life. And onward. That the situation of the Jews all through this period, from 70 A.D., we could even date it, certainly by 135, is treatment of second-class citizens, treatment as a general scapegoat whenever anything seemed to go wrong, whether it was economic or political or something else, attempts to force them into conversions to whatever particular views the rulers had in that period, confiscation of property, deportation again and again, and many, many killed. Something that is certainly very extreme, very unusual. It'd be very hard put to find another group of people for whom these same sorts of things have been said, and yet the Jews continue to survive it. There was no complete annihilation of the people. Through this period also, we see again rising of messianic claimants. Many, many ones. The last one, rather famous one, Shabbati Zvi, claimed to be the Messiah, gathered a very large group of people around him among the Jews, said he would lead them out of their distress and things of that sort. But then a very strange thing happened. This fellow was in Turkey, under the Turkish Empire. The authorities put him in prison, and they said, you've got two choices. You can die, or you can convert to Islam. Shabbati decided to take the Islam way out, and that was a little hard on his followers, as you can guess. But some of them even managed to justify that Shabati as the Messiah, and they had picked up some ideas. I guess they had been in some contact with Christianity, and the Christians had been showing them the passages of the suffering of the Messiah in Scripture. They decided that in order for the Messiah to suffer for sins, he had to commit quite a few. He had to go into quite a few, and so the depth would be going into Islam, apostatizing into Islam, and after he had done that, he would come out again. Well, there's still a few followers of Shabati still living in the world today, but in general, after this debacle, the Jews refused to recognize him anymore, and in fact began to get very skeptical of messianic claimants. And again we see the same remark of John, "I've come in my Father's name, and you won't receive me. But if another shall come in my own name, you will receive him." Even in America, where the Jews have probably been treated about as well as they ever have anywhere, there have been severe problems with persecution of the Jews. When the Jews first entered New Amsterdam, later become part of New York State, the council under Peter Stuyvesant decided that they must be under very severe restrictions, as we see here. And it was only with some vigorous protest, some outside help, that they were able to avoid this very severe problem. And certainly, even in this country, the Jews have in many ways been looked down upon by various other groups, distrusted, things of that sort, blamed when economic troubles have come up. There's still a very substantial anti-Semitic underground, we might call it, even today in this country. And yet this is a country where perhaps they've been treated better than any country in all the world. We come on then into the last century, about 1850. At this point, we can see that from 70 AD or 135 AD until 1850, part of Hosea chapter 3 has been rather well fulfilled. The sons of Israel will remain for many days without king or prince, no royal line, no one reigning, without government official, that's what prince would mean there, no government period, without sacrifice or sacred pillar, without ephod or household idols, no idolatry, strict sense of the word, but no Mosaic religion. The religion they've got is a definite modification, rather crucial point, the crucial point of forgiveness of sin. And after all, if your sins are not forgiven, one cannot stand before God. But so far, no sign of the fulfillment of verse 5. "Afterward, the sons of Israel shall return and seek the Lord their God and David their king." 1850, that would have seemed absurd to most people. What? The Jews return? The Jews, a downtrodden, ignorant people, packed into ghettos, in the few places in the world where they were really free to do much of anything, in the areas where they're not downtrodden, no interest in going anywhere. And in the places where there might be an interest in getting out, no wealth, and no particular inclination, even in the ghetto situation. How would verse 5 ever begin to be fulfilled? And yet, in the east of Europe, a number of men began to be concerned, as they had been allowed among the Jews to become educated in the Western tradition, as they had begun to be allowed to come into universities and things of that sort. One of these men, Theodor Herzl, decided that the Jews should have a state. Wrote a work, The Jewish State. He had thought at first that they would try and set up a state in Africa, where he thought it would not be too hard to get some land. But someone, I do not know who, talked him out of it, said the only place Israel can really have a state is Palestine, the home which God had given them. Well, Herzl didn't give up his idea, although there certainly did not seem to be anything promising about it. The homeland was in the control of the Muslims. Turkish Empire was getting weaker at this point, but it was still rather strong. The area was rather empty, but no great desire to have Jews coming back, and no great desire of Jews to go back. But Herzl began to publish his ideas, began to try and raise interest among the Jews for a return to the land. He was able to interest several very wealthy Jews, because even though there had been difficulties in many places. There were a number of places in Europe where the Jews had been allowed to undertake at least a sufficient amount of activity in the economic sphere and other areas that certain men had become wealthy. Baron Rothschild was interested in the project, and after visiting some sites of colonists who had been sent back, he decided to support it. Montefiore is another man who put forward a great deal of money, Englishman, English Jew, and helped to begin to provide a place for the Israelites to settle in Palestine. Another man comes on the scene at this period. Eliezer ben Yehuda goes through the Hebrew, ancient Hebrew language, and tries to restructure it in a way that would be easily spoken by people with a European background. He tries to work up a modern vocabulary because certain things have changed since 135 AD, and so needs words for electricity and airplanes and all of these other sorts of things. Eliezer ben Yehuda begins to revive the Hebrew language. And certainly you have a strange project afoot here. A language that has not been spoken by a nation for nearly 2,000 years, and a man decides he's going to try and revive it. And yet he succeeds in getting the colonists who have gone back to Palestine, a very small group, to begin to try and speak some of it. There are, of course, many people who would prefer their own languages, whether it be Yiddish or various other, but he begins to work in that direction. And now finally we come into the 20th century and to the First World War. The First World War on its southern frontier involves basically the question of how the Allies are to deal with Germany's ally, Turkey, a very sick and weak empire at this point. And what actually happens is that the Allies invade from different directions, the Russians from the north there, and the British come up from Egypt, which they've had under their control for some time, and they succeed in capturing Palestine by the time the war has ended, and Palestine is turned over to the British as a mandate territory, territory which they are to have control of until things can be set on their feet. It's at this point, 1917, that the British come in control of Palestine, and as they are coming into control of it, a British Jewish chemist named Chaim Weizmann appeals to the British government to agree that Israel will be a home for the Jews. 1917, Arthur James Balfour produces a white paper for the British government to Lord Rothschild that the British government is favorable to establishing Palestine as national homeland for the Jews. So finally, 1917, for the first time since 135 AD, the power controlling Palestine is willing that the Jews should be able to have it as a homeland. That does not end the complication, however. There are a large number of people in Palestine, the inhabitants, other than the Jews, who are not willing that Palestine should be a homeland for the Jews, who have in fact not been too happy about the settlements which have already taken place at this point. But this really opens the gate in a political way for an establishment of the Israeli nation, although it does not really get carried through very well in the years that follow. A difficult situation develops in the 20s and especially in the 30s as many, many Jews come back to Palestine and to begin to settle, begin to set up farms and things of that sort. They find that they have great opposition from Muslims in the area and that they have to basically build fortifications wherever they go. This is a model of a standard type of fortifications which plans were prepared for, and this fortification could be set up in one night. The colonists would slip in at night, set up their fortification, and the next day the Arabs would see a fortified compound already there, and then the Jews could begin to set up their farmlands. They would have a place they could stay at night. They would have a place from which they could direct fire if they were attacked. But they were still very disorganized. They still faced a serious problem that they did not have the weapons, they did not have the training, that the Arab guerrillas were able to get from other Arab countries, things of that sort. A rather interesting thing happened at this time in the 1930s. Among the British officers in Palestine, one was a Colonel Ord Wingate, who had come from Britain. He was a Christian who believed that God promised in the scriptures that Israel would one day again be back in their own land. And he believed that the colonists in the land at this time were in fact the beginning of the fulfillment of that. So he agreed, as a man trained in British Army tactics, and especially in guerrilla tactics, and in night fighting and things of that sort, that he would help train the Israeli colonists to be able to put together a self-defense force in order that they could hold their own against the Arab attacks. And the result was that he trained such an effective force that within a year, there were almost no Arab reprisals against the colonists. The men were trained in night fighting, in quick attack, and it became a very, very dangerous thing to go after any of the Israeli settlements. Back in Europe, another shadow had arisen on the scene with the rise of National Socialism. Adolf Hitler had developed a scheme by which the major economic problems of Germany were due to the Jewish race, a second-class race which was hindering the advance of the master race. And the only solution to this would be to get the Jews out of the economic life of Germany, if necessary, by killing them, although that was not Hitler's first intention, as far as we can tell. His first intention was to merely drive them out of the German areas and make them go settle somewhere else and leave all of their property behind. A very striking presentation of this is found in Nora Levin's work, The Holocaust, Destruction of European Jewry, 1933 to 1945. Situation in which the population of Europe, at least the areas which come under Hitler's control, as far as Jews are concerned, dropped by over 90% in this period, and for which there are excellent records that something on the order of 6 million Jews would represent probably one-third of the population of Jews in the world were killed during that period. Basically, the Germans proceeded in a very subtle method. They began by making certain laws that restricted the activities of the Jews. Restricted their economic activity, and a lot of Jews did not like it, but they said, well, we can put up with it. After all, we've lived all this time here. We have had a nice homeland. But then the restrictions begin to get stronger until finally, in many, many different areas, the Jews are forced to move into just one section of the city. Here in Warsaw, October 16, 1940, a command by the Germans in occupation of Warsaw, Poland, that all the Jews must go into one very small area of the city, which is to be walled off, not allowed to come out, but they must live right there. After a while, not allowed even to come out to work or anything of that sort, begins to become a very serious problem. There's an attempt, obviously, to get rid of these Jews by starvation, first of all. The situation is reached in which only a certain amount of food is allowed to go in the gate each day. It's be paid for by whatever means the Jews can find to pay for it, but only a certain amount is allowed to go in. It gets to the place where you're talking about 200 or 300 calories per person per day coming into the ghetto. And the Jews are very concerned about this, but the Nazis say, don't worry, we're not trying to kill you or anything of that sort, but it's a wartime situation, we don't have the food available, we're going to move you to the east and resettle you. So we will take you group by group, and we'll put you on railroad cars, and we'll lead you to a resettlement location in the east. Well, many of the Jews suspect that something is afoot, but most of them do not. Most of them think of the bad conditions in the Warsaw Ghetto and the prospect of being moved into an area where they can have their own land and farm and things of that sort. But finally, one of the men taken on one of these railroad trips is able to escape, and they find out that the railroad trip ends with a visit to the gas chamber in Treblinka, various other locations in Poland. And so a group within the ghetto decide that the only solution is to try and fight it out. Here you have a few thousand Jews left now, no weapons, most of them in a starved condition, and you have the Nazi army in occupation of Poland. And yet the fighters in the ghetto begin to make a defense, and the result is that in just a month, the Germans are able to destroy the ghetto completely. There are something like a half dozen younger Jews who are able to escape by traveling miles through the sewer system of Warsaw and coming up and finding people who would be able to protect them and get them out of the country. A very, very striking example of Nazi tactics in this situation. It's an excellent example of the way in which people did not believe that men could be that wicked, and therefore refused to believe reports that people were being gassed. The Europeans outside the control of Nazism did not believe that the Nazis could be doing this. The Jews are making up stories, they said, to get our help. The Jews in the ghettos would not believe that the Nazis were doing this. But it only shows another danger of a false theology, a theology that man is too good to do certain things. The biblical picture is that man, unless God prevents him, can sink to levels you would hardly believe. And those occasions occur many, many times in human history. Elsewhere, the gas chambers were not near enough, not easy enough. Men would be lined up in front of an open trench grave. Their clothes would be taken off so that they could be used for other purposes, and the people would be shot down, fall into the pits, and in the pits covered up with earth-moving equipment. Millions and millions of Jews killed. The estimate, around 6 million Jews, about one-third of the Jews in the world, killed in Hitler's solution to the Jewish problem. And here we see, within the range of recorded history, in the century of greatest enlightenment, as men would have it, what men are capable of, and we see very clearly the fulfillment of the curses which the Bible puts upon Israel for turning away from God. Your life shall hang in doubt before you, and you shall be in dread night and day. You shall have no assurance of your life. You want it to be morning when it's evening. You want it to be evening when it's morning. No rest for your foot. The Jews who wanted to escape from Europe normally could not. Very, very few countries were willing to expand their immigrant quotas to allow them in. And I think, although in no way exonerated or anything of that sort for it, a number of the Nazis testified at the trial that Hitler would not have killed them if he could have gotten them out, but couldn't get them out. The British, in control of Palestine, the most likely place for them to go, could not let them in because they wanted to keep peace with the Arabs. And the Arabs did not want more and more Jews coming in to raise that side until it would become something of a majority. The other countries of Europe would not, by and large, let them in. So that only a very small trickle of the Jews of Europe were able to get out of Europe before this destruction came upon them. Yet with the end of the war, you see a huge migration into Palestine. A great deal of illegal migration after the end of the war. Many, many Jews decided we're not going to get killed that way again. If we're going to get killed this time, it's going to be fighting. We must have a homeland of our own. We must have a place where we control the army. We must have a place where we can at least die defending ourselves rather than being herded in cattle cars and dumped in gas chambers. And so an enormous impetus to the growth of a country which, if you track this along, presuming no persecution, would put you still a very minor number of Jews in Palestine at the present day, and yet as a result it has grown all the way up over 2 million. So that now you have about one-fifth of the Jews in the world have gone back to Palestine. In the year 1948, the British finally decided that the Palestinian question was getting completely out of hand. They couldn't keep out the Jews who were slipping in. The Arabs were getting irked about the situation. They saw that they were beginning to lose control of Palestine. They were getting a larger and larger and larger minority of Jews, and if it kept up, it would be a majority. Fighting began among the groups back and forth. The British were caught in the middle. They were trying to keep the peace. But to keep the peace, they'd bring reprisal against one side, and then that side would bomb a British installation, and they would make a reprisal on something else, and the other side would bomb them, and meanwhile they're bombing each other. You really had a three-way situation in which the British felt they were getting shot at from both sides, weren't liked by either group. It's kind of like being an umpire in a baseball game and such, when both sides are really against each other and there's a huge crowd that's partisan to both sides, and every call you make is too much one way for the one group and too much the other way for the other group. And the British just did not know what to make of the thing. They finally said, "We've had enough. United Nations, you can have it. We're going to give it back to you. We're canceling our mandate." United Nations had replaced the League of Nations by this time. And so the United Nations was stuck with the problem. What are we going to do with the place? Well, they wanted at first to make one country with kind of like Lebanon, one country with a Jewish part and an Arab part, and they would elect members to the thing, and maybe the president would be Arab and the vice president would be Jewish, etc. But it became fairly clear with the history from 1918 to 1948 that that would not work. So they finally decided, the Jews were agreeable to it, the Arabs were not, that they would partition the country into two pieces. One piece would be a Jewish state, one piece would be an Arab state. And so the partition vote was passed in the United Nations, and very quickly then, the Jews got together a government, and David Ben-Gurion made the Declaration of Independence for the State of Israel, May 14th, 1948, a Jewish state, for the first time in almost 2,000 years. Very strange combination of events have led up to it. How did you get Jews in Palestine? Persecution from all the areas drove them back. How did you get anybody in Palestine that was even open to allowing the Jews to come back? Well, all the intricate details of international politics somehow wound up with Britain being closest to controlling Palestine. It's a pretty good trick, you consider where Great Britain is located. But they were in Egypt, and then they drove up through Palestine to fight the Turks, and so they had their troops when the war ended. And it just happened that one of their major war efforts had been led by a chemist named Chaim Weizmann. And he asked, as a favor, that they would support a Jewish homeland. They wavered back and forth on it for 20 years, but Jews kept coming into the place, and then they finally, when they had to give it up, their partition was made. The Arabs were not willing to accept the partition. The day that the State of Israel was declared, five Arab nations declared war on Israel. The five Arab nations had standing armies. One of them had been trained by the British. Another one was British, vaguely, I guess. Some had been trained by the French. They weren't anything fantastic by European standards, but there were armies with tanks and cannon and uniforms and fairly modern weapons and all of that sort of thing, coming in from different directions all at once. You say, how could they lose? They lost. They lost. It's hard to say. They faced tanks with rifles. And the Jews did not have the equipment to go against them. The Jews had to make Molotov cocktails, which are pretty nice for throwing through front windows of buildings, but aren't normally too hot on tanks. And yet, with very crude equipment, they were still able to win a decisive victory against the Arabs in the just a matter of 6 months, 1948. Since that time, with much better equipment, they have generally done better. Certainly 56 and the 67, the Six-Day War, and the Yom Kippur War are certainly a much closer thing, where you have the United States supplying the latest equipment to Israel, sort of, and the Russians supplying the latest equipment to Syria and Egypt with a much more open hand. But as it happened, in the initial state, the state in which they were most vulnerable, with no equipment to speak of, the Jews were able to win a victory. There are, of course, many human factors involved, tricks of various sorts by which Jewish entrepreneurs were able to buy up weapons manufacturing equipment and complicated weapons in various places where the Allied nations were selling off their surplus. You know, this is right after World War II. Take the thing to pieces completely, something like a press for making rifles, take it to pieces completely, pack it in crates, ship it into Israel as farm equipment. The inspectors open it up and it's tons of pieces. What can you tell? And then laboriously put it back together in a building and start manufacturing your own weapons. Very, very interesting story of the war. I would recommend to you O Jerusalem, rather nicely done work on the Jewish War, 1948. Interesting also that a very important factor was the very well-trained army that the Jews had, poorly equipped, but well-trained. And the Jews themselves, almost all these pictures have come out, a picture book of Jewish history done by the Jews, credit Ord Wingate, the Plymouth Brethren fellow from Britain, who believed that God would take the Israelites back to Palestine and that he would save them there with the return of the Messiah. This man, Ord Wingate, responsible for training the Israeli army. So we come to 1967, and Israel starting in 48, very, very vulnerable, an area in which they had an enormous territory to guard with very narrow spaces in several spots. In the 67 war, they were able to expand, pick up the Sinai Peninsula, and about half of their needed oil, able to recapture the city of Jerusalem. It's interesting to look at this point, back at Isaiah 11, verse 11 and following. Then it will happen on that day that the Lord will again recover the second time with his hand the remnant of his people who will remain from Assyria, Egypt, Patros, Cush, Elam, Shinar, Hamath, and from the islands of the sea. He will lift up a standard for the nations, will assemble the banished ones of Israel. He will gather the dispersed of Judah from the four corners of the earth. Then the jealousy of Ephraim, the northern kingdom, will depart. Those who harass Judah will be cut off. Ephraim will not be jealous of Judah. No northern kingdom, southern kingdom jealousy. Well, we have just had a return of many Israelites, not all yet, many Israelites to Palestine in this century. We find one state concocted, and so there's no longer the jealousy between the northern and southern kingdom. They will swoop down on the slopes of the Philistines on the west. Well, there's nobody living there by the name of the Philistines yet, but if we were to back up and look at the area of the Philistines, we still have a location named for one of the major Philistine cities, the Gaza Strip, one of the areas which the Israelis had to neutralize in their 67 war. They swooped down upon the Philistines on the west. Together they will plunder the sons of the east, together meaning Judah and Ephraim, plunder the sons of the east. And of course you have Iraq and Syria and Jordan, all of those will possess Edom and Moab. They certainly have taken away all of the Transjordan, all of the east side of the Jordan River from the nation which has its capital city at Amman, which is a cognate word to Ammon, so I think that's fair, and which controls the territory of Edom. I don't know whether that's exactly what is intended here or whether we look forward to yet another warfare. Don't know whether this has anything to do with the Suez Canal. Getting tricky. Don't know what the Sea of Egypt is, what the destruction of the tongue of it is. We don't know. Difficult thing. But it's very clear in this passage that there will be a regathering, that it will come from certain places, that it will produce a nation which is united, that they will fight with their neighbors, and rather successfully too. When we now go back to see the lands mentioned in Isaiah 11:1, we see that Egypt, Patros, and Cush are basically what we call Egypt today. That Hamath is basically what we call Syria, that Assyria, Shinar, etc., is basically Iraq and over across the river, Iran, and that the coastlands of the sea would be basically North Africa and Europe. When we begin to look at the return of people to Israel, there have, of course, been an enormous return from Europe. From the areas under Nazi control in World War II, almost all of the Jews have left. From the areas nearby, Iraq, up around the Tigris-Euphrates River, in 1947, a year before the declaration of the Israeli state, there were 150,000 Jews in Iraq. In 1967, 20 years later, there are 2,500. Basically, the Jews have left
Iraq. Basically, the Jews have left Syria in 67. Even then, four-fifths of the Jews had already left. Basically, the Jews had left Egypt by 67, 66,000 to 2,500. Number of Jews in Egypt now, neglecting possible Jews who are working for European countries of some sort and are considered Europeans, is down to something like four or five families. So it's not even 2,500 anymore. The only land mentioned that has not been basically depopulated of Jews as yet is Iran. But we're not saying that the completion of these fulfillments have occurred, but that the beginning seems very definitely to have started in this return fulfillment. Well, we've looked a little bit at the history of Israel. We thought about the disasters that the Bible says would come upon Israel. They turned away from God. We saw that they turned into idolatry, Old Testament times, and half of them were hauled off by the Assyrians to the Tigris River. That they continued in idolatry in the southern kingdom, and that half was hauled off to Babylon. They were later allowed to return. Continued. They were harassed off and on, but not terribly badly treated over many years during the rest of the period BC until we come to 70 AD. Now the strange thing is that the Bible predicted itself that they would not be troubled much by idolatry thereafter, and yet for some reason they were taken out of their land and scattered for nearly 2,000 years. We see a brief scattering of the southern kingdom for idolatry. They were scattered 70 years and allowed to return. Now they've been scattered nearly 2,000 years and are beginning to return. And the Jews have been having a hard time figuring out why such a long scattering when they're doing their best to keep God's word. I suppose one might argue whether they're doing exactly their best since they have not reinstituted sacrifice. They have not tried to sacrifice anywhere else. They have not carried out that part, but surely a person would say, well, that's not nearly as bad as idolatry, and yet they were only out of the land for 70 years for idolatry. To my knowledge, Judaism does not have an answer to that problem. Why it is that Israel has been exiled for 2,000 years, they don't seem to be worse than the Old Testament Israelites were, who were turning away from God every generation almost, and yet they were only exiled for 70 years. Very interesting. The Christians have another explanation that seems to make sense of the data. For refusing to keep God's law of letting the land rest on its sabbatical years, for going into idolatry, the southern kingdom was exiled for 70 years. Christianity says Israel has been exiled for these 2,000 years because they rejected the Messiah. He came to his own, and his own did not receive him. I come in my Father's name, he said, and yet you won't receive me. But if another will come in his name, you'll receive him. And they've done that again and again and again. What's this picture all about? Radio telescope. Men are looking out into space for signs of intelligent life. There is intelligent life in the universe. Smarter than man. One of those persons has been trying to communicate with men for thousands of years in his word, the Bible. And he's been showing that he exists by detailed statements of how he was going to deal with the nation Israel through all this time. And as you look through this material and you look through the history of Israel, you find a wonderful fit. And yet men do not want that message from outer space because it does not speak comfort to them. What can we do about this material? We can pretend it's not there. In nominally Christian countries for the last 150 years, men have decided that there is no such thing as the supernatural, at least in the sense of intervening in history, and therefore have refused to examine these very matters regarding whether or not there is a God who is acting in history, who fulfills his own word in the scripture. I've tried to show you tonight that a study of the nation Israel certainly points that way. But men, many of them, are not willing to have that solution to the problems of life. Yet the biblical picture is that whether they're willing to have that solution or not doesn't change the fact. God does have control of history. Jesus himself said, as he spoke the last time to the religious leaders of Israel, "O Jerusalem, Jerusalem, who kills the prophets and stones those who are sent to her, how often I wanted to gather your children together, the way a hen gathers her chicks under her wings, and you were unwilling. Behold, your house is being left to you desolate, for I say to you that from now on you shall not see me until you say, 'Blessed is he who comes in the name of the Lord.'" You will not see the Messiah until they are willing to greet him as Messiah. That is God's message. That is Jesus' message to Israel. Your house is left to your desolate. The destruction of the temple will take place and has continued to this day. And we understand that from other biblical materials that Israel will try to rebuild their temple and succeed, but they will succeed only in bringing upon themselves the last great false Messiah. That a time of disaster is coming, and the only way to be ready is to be looking to Jesus, the Messiah. In that day, those who are left, and the Bible pictures a very small remnant of the Israelites living in Palestine, will survive the disasters which the anti-Messiah, the Antichrist, will bring upon them. In that day, at the last point, when Israel is surrounded by its enemies, about to be destroyed, God himself will intervene. And it says in verse 10 of Zechariah chapter 12, "I will pour out on the house of David and on the inhabitants of Jerusalem the spirit of grace and a supplication. They will pray to me, so that they will look on me whom they have pierced. They will mourn for him as one mourns for an only son. They will weep bitterly over him like the bitter weeping over a firstborn." And then the biblical material says, "Then there will come cleansing upon the house of Israel." God will open a fountain for cleansing. That Israel has ignored the biblical statement that there is no cleansing, no forgiveness without sacrifice, all these 2,000 years, and God will finally bring the cleansing, which comes in the person of his Messiah, who had once 2,000 years ago come to suffer and to die himself as the sacrifice for sin.
Other helpful cassettes are available from Biblical Theological Seminary. For a free copy of our cassette catalog or other information about the seminary, please write to Biblical Theological Seminary, 200 North Main Street, Post Office Box 9, Hatfield, Pennsylvania, zip code 19440.